Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The Liberian president ends a state of emergency, and Doctors Without Borders launching 3 Ebola treatment trials. I'm Joe Palco, reporting from Washington. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is ending the state of emergency she instituted because of the Ebola crisis. In a speech on Thursday, Ms. Sirleaf said that Ebola is not over, but that some restrictions will remain in place.
Until the national goal of 0 new cases by Christmas is achieved, all across the country, we will keep many of the previous measures in place with appropriate adjustments consistent with the progress in our fight.
The Liberian president said markets can reopen and a curfew will be pushed back to midnight in non-affected areas. She said hotspots for the virus continue to appear in rural areas, but the worst may be over. Police in central India have arrested a doctor who performed sterilization procedures at a government-run health camp that left at least 13 women dead. Officials say Dr. R.K. Gupta was taken into custody late Wednesday in Chhattisgarh State. Now, he's denied responsibility for the deaths and said the women became ill due to tainted post-surgery medication. The doctors reported to perform sterilization surgeries on more than 80 people in less than 6 hours on Saturday. And U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is due to meet Thursday with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the talks in Amman, Jordan, will likely focus on how to lower tensions with Israel and rebuilding efforts in the Gaza Strip. For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The medical aid group MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, says the first clinical trials of potential treatments for the deadly Ebola virus are expected to begin early next month in 3 West African Ebola treatment centers. MSF will host the clinical trials, which will be led by 3 research groups. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Doctors Without Borders says the 3 clinical trials are aimed at quickly finding an effective therapy against the deadly Ebola virus, which has claimed more than 5,000 lives. Peter Horby, the chief investigator for the drug trial being led by Oxford University, says the only way to know whether available drugs work on Ebola patients is to test them during an epidemic.
If we're going to find a treatment, we have to do it now, which is why we have to accelerate these trials. And it's very challenging. We're going fast by clinical trial standards, maybe not fast enough for the people on the ground.
The drugs were chosen on the basis of their safety and efficacy and also on their availability. First results could be available in February. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In the final trial, the Antwerp Institute of Tropical Medicine will test how well Ebola patients respond when given blood or plasma that contains antibodies from people who have survived the virus. President Barack Obama is attending the summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which Myanmar is hosting this year. President Obama praised Myanmar and its leader for hosting the gathering.
During the past 6 years, we've made great strides in elevating and expanding this partnership, but I think we all agree we can still do more. And that's why the United States is committed to strengthening ASEAN, both as an institution and as a community of nations bound by our shared interests and values.
But after attending meetings on regional cooperations, Mr. Obama got to the more substantial part of his agenda, which was promoting political reforms in Myanmar that he says have not come as fast as many had hoped 4 years ago when the country began its transition from decades of military rule. Officials of the European Space Agency say a small probe is definitely resting on the surface of a distant comet after a rough and uncertain landing. Now, the agency released a picture early Thursday taken by the probe of the rocky surface of the comet 67P. Now, the photo suggests that it is sitting at an angle, but ground controllers say the probe is working well and still transmitting data. The vehicle became the first ever man-made object to land on a comet when it touched down on Wednesday, 7 hours after separating from its Rosetta mothership. For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. From the VOA News Center in Washington, this is Joe Palca.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The medical aid group MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, says the first clinical trials of potential treatments for the deadly Ebola virus are expected to begin early next month in three West African Ebola treatment centers.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the U.S. Senate is considering an Obama administration request for an additional $6 billion to fight the Ebola outbreak.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Lesotho, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization published new numbers for the Ebola epidemic yesterday. Since March of this year, more than 14,000 have been infected and more than 5,000 have died. The major economic powers meeting in Brisbane, Australia, were given a grim picture of working conditions in the Ebola clinics of West Africa. A Liberian nurse caring for infected patients told the G20 members she has no rubber gloves and wears a plastic bag instead of the required yellow personal protective suits. Among other topics, the G20 is expected to address the health crisis in West Africa. The U.S. is expected to ask the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, to forgive the $100 million in debt owed by Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea in order to focus on their medical crisis. The IMF is also expected to create a multi-billion dollar emergency fund to anticipate future pandemics. But the international aid agency, Oxfam, cautions that about half of the G20 member nations have failed to give adequate funding for the crisis. The president of the Nigerian Nurses Association, Abra Dafio Adeniji, told G20 members the infection in West Africa is a world tragedy. Adeniji said it takes just one person with Ebola to get into a country, and then the country will be on fire.
In South Sierra Leone, hundreds of nurses, porters, and cleaners in an Ebola treatment center have gone on strike, claiming the government failed to pay them $100 weekly hazard pay. A few health workers remain at work at the clinic, but the international medical staff says they are not able to keep the clinic running without the health workers. The clinic is in the town of Bandajuma and is run by Doctors Without Borders. In Mali, which shares a 500-mile border with Guinea, four people have died of Ebola. The first case was a 2-year-old girl who was carried from Guinea to Case, Mali. Health authorities have traced more than 90 contacts, including some UN peacekeepers in Case and the capital Bamako. 41 of those contacts have passed a 3-week monitoring with no symptoms of the virus. Mali's president, Boubacar Keita, has urged WHO and the governments of the region to establish a permanent information exchange to disseminate public health and hygiene information.
The medical aid group MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, says the first clinical trials of potential treatments for the deadly Ebola virus are expected to begin early next month in three West African Ebola treatment centers. MSF will host the clinical trials, which will be led by three research groups. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Doctors Without Borders says the three clinical trials are aimed at quickly finding an effective therapy against the deadly Ebola virus, which has claimed more than 5,000 lives, mainly in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. It says two experimental antiviral drugs, favipiravir and rinkidofovir, will be tested in Guinea and in an as-yet-unconfirmed location. A third clinical trial using convalescent whole blood from Ebola survivors and plasma therapy will take place in the Guinean capital of Conakry. Peter Horby, the chief investigator for the drug trial being led by Oxford University, says the only way to know whether available drugs work on Ebola patients is to test them during an epidemic.
If we're going to find a treatment, we have to do it now, which is why we have to accelerate these trials. And it's very challenging. We're going fast by clinical trial standards, maybe not fast enough for the people on the ground. And I think these trials are not a moment too soon. We hope that we can identify if there is any effective treatments out there and make them available as soon as we can.
The drugs were chosen on the basis of their safety and efficacy and also on their availability. Annick Antierens, the head of experimental Ebola products for Doctors Without Borders, says a number of promising drugs were not considered for these clinical trials because none were available to give patients after previous trials ended. She tells VOA this is a therapeutic trial, so every patient that is confirmed with the disease will be given the opportunity to engage in the trial.
It means that people who are infected and who are coming into the treatment centers and who have been confirmed by a laboratory test to have Ebola infection, who now do not have a treatment besides supportive treatment, they would be asked, there would be a very impressive informed consent. There will be explained about the pros and the cons and the safety problems and the fact that it's experimental treatments. And then whoever accepts to be part of the trial will be given.
Doctors Without Borders says if a drug does nothing to reduce the fatality rate of Ebola patients, which now stands at about 50%, then the trial will stop and will continue with another drug. However, if the results are good and the survival rate goes beyond 80%, then it says the trial will stop and the drug will be made available to other Ebola patients. First results could be available in February. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Liberia President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is expected to announce very soon whether to extend or end the country's state of emergency over Ebola. It's been in effect since August, but the number of new cases has fallen sharply. Meanwhile, the Ebola crisis has hit Liberian families very hard. Even members are not infected. A new survey shows food security is being strained by the outbreak, with families eating fewer and smaller meals. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The humanitarian agency Mercy Corps has surveyed hundreds of households and vendors in the capital Monrovia and Lofa and Nimba counties. The survey shows 66% of households are making less money, and that's having a ripple effect on daily meals. Javier Alvarez, Mercy Corps' country director, says Liberia does not have a food shortage. It's more a matter of people not having access to food.
We are saying that commodities are not moving around the way they should be doing or the way they used to do pre-Ebola. The government has put in some extreme measures, like calling for a state of emergency, where they have minimized the movement of people and goods.
The survey shows that lower incomes, combined with a lack of access to food markets, have had a number of effects. About 90% of households surveyed say they're reducing the amount of food they eat at each meal, or they're substituting lower quality or less expensive food. And 85% of households surveyed say they're eating fewer meals each day. Also, household debt is increasing because people are buying food on credit or borrowing money to do so. And the food they are buying has become more expensive. Part of that is due to food imports now arriving mostly by ship. In August, the Liberian government closed the borders with Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Ivory Coast. It also recommended that weekly food markets be closed to try to prevent the spread of the Ebola virus. So, cross-border trade suffered, and access to food shrank. Alvarez says it's time for the Liberian government to reassess some of its emergency policies.
We want them to start thinking that access to market is very important to ensure food security for a household.
Mercy Corps says transportation has always been a problem in Liberia due to poor roads, but the rainy season makes it worse. For example, it says there are fewer trucks carrying food products from Nimba County. Only about four or five trucks make the run each day during the rainy season, instead of 8 to 10 trucks in the dry season. The trucks that do make the run must pass through Ebola checkpoints, which also slow delivery. Mercy Corps recommends infrastructure improvements, including roads, and increasing the number of trucks transporting food. It also proposes opening some border areas with tight Ebola monitoring to allow food imports. Cash transfers are another possibility. One method is paying local residents for repair work. That would boost their purchasing power and the local economy. Health officials report steadily declining Ebola cases in Liberia. But Alvarez says this is not the time for the country to lower its guard.
We have a real challenge. We have hotspots all across Liberia, making sure that we look after the hotspots. We in Mercy Corps believe this is not only a health emergency. This needs to be complemented with social mobilization and ensuring that economic recovery is in place from day one from the emergency.
Part of the plan to ensure food security and revive the local economy includes helping farmers get ready for the new planting season. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Joe. Also in Washington, the U.S. Senate Appropriations Committee is considering an Obama administration request for an additional $6 billion to fight the Ebola outbreak. Yesterday, the committee held a hearing on the crisis. Among those testifying was Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci last testified before the committee a month and a half ago. He was asked to give a status report on Ebola cases in the U.S.
At the time that we met last time, we were still in the stage of doing contact tracing of people who were exposed in this country. And as it turns out, now, when you look at the contacts of the infected individuals, they are now beyond the 21-day period. So we can now comfortably say that the United States of America is Ebola-free. And that's something I couldn't tell you at the last hearing because we were not sure at the time. The next is that we've made a significant progress on the road to the testing of a vaccine for its efficacy because we had just started the phase one trial at the time of the last hearing. And now the results look good in that trial, and we're all set to go at the end of the year into the efficacy trial in West Africa.
Fauci also commented on the sharp decline in Ebola cases in Liberia.
The downturn in Liberia is encouraging. We're not saying that the ball game is over by any means, but the downturn there is encouraging, which means that the prevention and contact tracing and funeral issues have worked.
Some patients have been treated with the blood of Ebola survivors. It's hoped the antibodies in the blood will attack the virus. Dr. Fauci was asked whether health officials can confirm that such a treatment actually works.
No, we can't. And I'm glad you asked that, because that is the real important argument for doing the controlled clinical trials that we are now planning. We had a meeting last evening at the NIH where we brought together all of the people who had taken care of Ebola patients in the United States. We had Nebraska there, we had Emory there, we had the NIH there, and we had others. And when we looked at the data, Tim Uecki from the CDC presented all of the data, and it was clear that we had no idea what works or what doesn't work because it was just given on an empiric basis, which is a very strong argument for clinical trials.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He testified yesterday before the U.S. Senate Appropriations Committee.
Amid sporadic fighting between Islamist militias and the country's official armed forces, several bomb attacks were reported in the capital, Tripoli, against the Egyptian and the UAE, the United Arab Emirates embassies. Both Egypt and the UAE have expressed strong support for the Libyan military against the Islamists. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
موجز الثانية لأهم الأنباء، أهلا بكم. قال المتحدث الرسمي باسم درع ليبيا في المنطقة.
Libyan TV, quoting a spokesman for the Islamist Fajr militia coalition which controls Tripoli, reported that a car bomb exploded in front of the Egyptian embassy without causing any casualties. It said nearby buildings were slightly damaged by the blast. Militia spokesman Ahmed Hadia claimed that certain parties are trying to take advantage of bad relations between his group and the current Egyptian government in order to destabilize the Libyan capital.
He
insisted that adequate security measures were in place in Tripoli and that even in a stable environment, lapses occur from time to time. He went on to say that such acts of terrorism would be quashed without pity along with those who commit them. Egyptian analyst and commentator Hisham Qassem tells VOA that he thought Egypt and the UAE were singled out in the attacks because of their stance against the Islamist militias, which control wide swaths of Libya and elsewhere.
It's a confrontation between that terror belt and the governments of the region who have decided to stand up to it. Egypt and Emirates being definitely hardcore in that coalition against them. What you have now is a full-fledged confrontation, and we're going to be seeing a lot of desperate measures as things progress.
Libyan TV also reported that a second car bomb went off in front of the United Arab Emirates embassy as well, although other reports claim that the bomb was defused. The TV showed a photo of what appeared to be a burned-out vehicle in front of a building which looked intact. Heavy fighting was reported overnight in the eastern city Benghazi between Islamist militiamen and forces loyal to former army commander Khalifa Haftar. Witnesses say Grad rockets and rocket-propelled grenades were fired in the center of the city. Libyan TV reported that the Red Crescent carried out its largest evacuation to date of families in the central districts of Benghazi affected by the fighting. Red Crescent spokesman Taufik Shukri says more than 1,000 people were taken to more secure locations. He says that the Red Crescent has 4 or 5 locations for displaced people that are outside the worst hit areas and more safe. But he added the situation in Benghazi was very tense due to the intermittent fighting. In political developments, the head of Libya's crisis government, now based in the eastern city of Tobruk, Abdullah Athani, met with top Saudi officials during a visit to the capital, Riyadh. Athani and his top army commander reportedly met with Saudi intelligence chief Khalid bin Bandar bin Abdulaziz. Several car bombs went off in eastern Libya Wednesday, including one near the Abrak air base used by the prime minister when he travels. Another bombing in Tobruk, seat of the Libyan parliament, left 3 people dead, including the suicide bomber. The government moved to Tobruk after militants forced them from the capital and declared their own rival government. In Cairo, Algerian Prime Minister Abdelmalek Sellal met with Egyptian officials Thursday to discuss the security situation in Libya. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
23 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Islamic militants killed 5 Egyptian policemen and soldiers this morning at roadblocks in the Sinai Peninsula. Masked gunmen stopped pickup trucks near the towns of Sheikh Zuwayid and Rafah and shot the security officers. The north of the peninsula has been under a state of emergency since 31 soldiers died when a rocket struck a military personnel carrier containing explosives. Islamist attacks on government facilities increased after the ouster of Mohamed Morsi as president of the country last year. In other morning violence, 8 sailors are missing after militants in 3 fishing boats attacked a naval gunboat near Damietta. 5 crew members were injured as the vessel burned. Government helicopters intercepted the attackers and arrested 32 rebels. And in Cairo, the explosion of a stun grenade on a subway triggered a panic in which 16 people were injured.
A quick and painless way to test people for river blindness in 31 African countries was announced this month. More than 18 million people are infected with the parasite that causes river blindness. But previous tests made it hard to find those who were susceptible. PATH is a nonprofit international health organization based in Seattle, Washington. The agency announced a small new device called the SD BioLine onchocerciasis, IPG4 rapid test, a test that could find more of those people who have contracted the parasite that blinds thousands in Africa. River blindness is caused by a parasite that passes easily from human to human. The transmission begins when a black fly bites a person. Symptoms include a painful itch that can become chronic as the microscopic worm migrates to the cornea of the eye and causes permanent blindness. PATH estimates as many as 180 million people living near fast-moving rivers are susceptible to the parasites. Most live in 11 countries of Central and Western Africa. There is a cure called Invextine. However, it only works if health workers can find the people infected with the parasite in time to prevent the blindness. PATH's Vice President for Product Development, David Kaslow, says this week the new test was developed by a South Korean company, Standard Diagnostics. The new test will enable health workers in poverty-stricken rural areas to give a simple, painless test.
So this has been a long-standing program, initially Merck and the Carter Center using ivermectin to treat river blindness. So we still have a really good drug. The question now is where is the disease still prevalent? And going in and identifying the populations that still have the parasite and clearing them, and then also using this test to continue to survey those populations to make sure that they remain free of disease. And if you see it recur, to quickly go in and treat again with a drug like ivermectin to clear that population of the parasite before it spreads.
In the past, testing was more difficult to perform in the remote communities where river blindness prevails. PATH tested the new procedure in Togo.
Previous testing required, you know, snipping skin, looking at underneath the microscope, required, you know, specific equipment and reagents, testing reagents. This one is quite simple, quite convenient, actually quite rapid, and that makes it less expensive.
The new test for river blindness is not only less expensive, but easier to conduct and gives quick results.
You take a drop of blood and you put it onto what's called a rapid diagnostic that takes that drop of blood and it just works right on a strip of filter paper. It uses somewhat of a similar technology as to the pregnancy test that we use in the developed world. So very much like a self-administered pregnancy test that allows you to do this at the site cheaply and simply. Right, so the idea is that you could test the population out there, healthcare workers, drop a blood, have an answer in about 20 minutes.
With a better test, health officials will be able to find more people who are infected with the parasite. Then they can offer a cure and reduce transmissions of the disease that leads to river blindness. If these countries can reduce the pain and suffering of these neglected tropical disease, the World Health Organization hopes to eradicate the river blindness in 5 years. Kaslow calls this goal aspirational. Drug companies, donors, and nonprofits pledged 2 years ago in London to meet a World Health Organization goal of ending 10 of 17 neglected tropical diseases by 2020. Kaslow says it depends on the political will of these global partners to make that happen. River blindness is one of 17 tropical diseases that PATH and many other agencies are battling.
This notion of, you know, each of these individual neglected tropical diseases may not look like they have as big a burden, let's say, as HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis. But when you combine them all together, you're talking about a huge disease burden, which is why we think that developing tools against a variety of these is critically, critically important.
Kaslow says PATH and its partners around the world are targeting all 17 diseases to offer relief to victims of these diseases and to boost the productivity of the economies of the countries. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The U.S. Senate is considering an Obama administration request for an additional $6 billion to fight the Ebola outbreak. The World Health Organization warns that millions of people every year, mainly in developing countries, die from indoor air pollution caused by dangerous fuels and cook stoves in the home. Coming up, we'll have music from Lesotho, and in our feature segment, a call for Zimbabwe to address its human rights issues. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off once again with African football.
Let's kick off with African football, Kim. The penultimate round in 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying will be played on Friday and Saturday, with the final round of matches on November 19th. There are two fixtures on Friday. Botswana will host Tunisia, and Ivory Coast is at home against Sierra Leone. Our African football guru, David Legg, is picking the elephants of Ivory Coast to win in Abidjan.
I think that's an Ivory Coast victory. It's really a match they need to win. They had that shock 4-3 home defeat by DR Congo in their last game. And it's quite interesting what's been going on in the Ivorian camp. They recalled two of their veteran defenders who had been ditched after the poor World Cup performance. They were Kolo Touré and Didier Zakora. Now, Zakora obviously didn't take his ditching very well because he's now refused to come. He says he's not interested. Sierra Leone, Sonny, you've got to feel very sorry for that country. They are, of course, at the very epicenter of the Ebola crisis, which has claimed almost 5,000 lives. And the vast majority of those are in those three countries in West Africa, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. And on behalf of the Sunny Side of Sport, we send our very best wishes to all those people in those countries battling that deadly virus. And what that virus has done, Sunny, among many other things, is it has meant that Sierra Leone have not been able to host any matches. They also have not been able to find a neutral venue. They wanted to go to Ghana, but they were unable to secure a deal. So they have had to play their home matches at the grounds of their opponents. In other words, they played DRC in Lubumbashi. They played Cameroon in Yaounde. And now a home fixture against Ivory Coast. They must play that in Abidjan. So it's very difficult for Sierra Leone. And I guess, not surprising, they've only managed to take 1 point from four matches. In their previous game against the Ivorians, they put up a good fight. They lost by 2-1. I think it'll be close, Sonny, but my prediction, Ivory Coast to win.
David, in Friday's other Nations Cup qualifier, the Zebras of Botswana will host the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia. The Tunisians on top of that table. And from my perspective, looks like they're going through to the finals, David. But your thoughts?
That's right, Sonny. You're spot on. A draw or a victory, and Tunisia will secure a place in the finals. It's interesting because the first time they met, way up in the north in Monastir, Botswana actually led from just before halftime and lost the match in stoppage time at the end of the game when, for some reason best known to the Botswana player, he raised his hand when he could easily have headed the ball clear from a cross. Referee correctly pointed to the penalty spot. Tunisia converted, and they snatched a 2-1 victory. Now, since then, things have gone really well for the Tunisians. They went to Egypt and won 1-0. They went to Senegal and held a good Senegalese side 0-0. And then in the return match, right at the death, again in stoppage time, the Tunisians snatched a 1-0 victory. And what all that means, Sonny, is they're comfortably placed. They've got 10 points. Senegal have got 7. Egypt, the record 7-time champions, have got 6. And Botswana are the only country who have not secured a single point in this qualifying competition. They've played 4, and they've lost all 4. But they haven't been overwhelmed. They've conceded an average of 2 goals a game. They haven't conceded more than 2 in any match. They'll put up a good fight, Sonny and Habaroni, but Tunisia certainly should be capable of at least getting 1 point. And I stress, it's just 1 point they need, and that will secure them a place in the 2015 finals, where, of course, we don't know yet.
David, it's time now for our latest African football quiz question. And the first 3 correct answers will win some of those much coveted and delightful VOA goodies. And now David will give us his latest African football quiz question.
Thanks, Sammy. And the question is as follows. It's African Cup of Nations qualifying time, so I thought it would be a good subject. Which country or countries have never lost at home in an Africa Cup of Nations qualifying match? Now, I stress qualifying match. This question has got nothing to do with the final tournament. Let me repeat that question. Which country or countries have never lost at home in an Africa Cup of Nations qualifying match? And that covers the period from 1966, when the first qualifiers were played, right up, Sonny, till now. In other words, 4 match days into the 2015 competition. And the very best of luck to all those African football wizards out there who listen religiously to our show.
And now David and I will give our addresses where you can send those entries for David's latest African football quiz question.
VOA! It's david.legg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.legg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
Voice of America!
You can send me email at sonny@voanews.com. Sonny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Voice of America!
Hi, I'm Shegwade Yemin, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on. This is for the world. Just come out and play with
this
me.
This is for the globe.
Just come out and play with
this
me.
This is for the world.
Just come out and play with
this
me.
This is for the globe.
Hey.
This is for the world.
Just come out and play with
this
me.
This is for the globe.
Just come out and play with
this
me.
This is for the world.
Just come out and play with
this
me.
This is for the globe.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, joins us now with a story on a new anti-racism sports initiative kicking off in Johannesburg.
A comprehensive initiative to battle against racism in sports in general and football in particular, Global Watch, was launched in Johannesburg, South Africa on Wednesday. The global founding partners of Global Watch are the Nelson Mandela Foundation, the Doha Goal Forum, and Sekwale Foundation. Former South African Cabinet Minister Tokyo Sekwale outlines their objective.
Global Watch simply says no to discrimination in all areas of all sports. We're saying the time has come for us to say it is enough that black people are insulted. When I say black people, I include all dark-skinned people worldwide. But it doesn't stop there. Racism and discrimination affects other nations as well. You find somebody says, I will not play Shinji Kagawa because he's Japanese. But it's more hurtful when it takes the form of direct colors. Global Watch is a call, therefore, action. by all right thinking to take a stand against these societal problems which are spilling onto the playing field. That's one. Global Watch says we are having a summit here in Johannesburg next week to be addressed by, amongst others, Thabo Mbeki, FIFA, International Olympics Committee, to be addressed by members of the Human Rights Commission in the world, United Nations, but also we have people who have played sports. The objective of this summit is to arrive at a global charter. A global charter will have basic set of principles of do's and don'ts in sport. What do you do with that? Then there's a barometer. A barometer is to check adherence to the charter, and that is going to result in not just education and awareness, which is good, monitoring and prevention and advocacy, but in punitive sanctions. Let the sanctions bite to the extent of bringing criminal action, taking criminal steps against perpetrators of racism.
That was Tokyo Sekwale, the Global Watch founder. I'm Mark Ome in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Because
this is Africa. This time for Africa.
Turning to tennis, it's looking more and more like Serbian star Novak Djokovic will end the year as the world's top-ranked men's player. Djokovic easily defeated Swiss player Stan Wawrinka 6-3 and 6-love at the ATP Finals in London. Djokovic will be guaranteed to finish atop the rankings for the third time in 4 years if he wins his final round-robin match against Thomas Berdych at the Elite Men's Tournament in the British capital. Spanish star Rafael Nadal is not competing in London. He's already sidelined for the rest of the season after having his appendix removed last week. But there's more ailing Rafa. His doctor says the 14-time Grand Slam singles champion will receive stem cell treatment on his ailing back. Dr. Angel Ruiz Cotoro told the Associated Press that stem cells will be put into a joint in Nadal's spine next week in Barcelona. In pro basketball news, let's give a sunny side of sports shout-out for my favorite club, the Washington Wizards. The Wizards beat the Detroit Pistons here in Washington Wednesday night, 107-103, for their sixth win of the season against two losses. It's the best start for Washington in 39 years. Kobe Bryant and the Los Angeles Lakers, meanwhile, continue to struggle. Kobe scored 33 points Wednesday night, but it wasn't enough as the Lakers lost to the New Orleans Pelicans 109-102. The Lakers dropped to a record of 1 win and 7 losses for the season. Tough season for Kim Lewis's favorite player, Kobe Bryant,
yes,
and
yes.
The Lakers.
Sorry, Kobe.
Kobe will come back, though, Kim. I know it. Kobe can come back.
Go Wizards. Go Wizards.
I'm BOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Kim.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Kenya's mobile money industry could undergo a serious shakeup thanks to a new technology. And next, a call for Zimbabwe to address its human rights issues. But first, some music. Here is L.A. Forbes of Lesotho with Spiral Aloe.
Nubale kibimba nanda bisakiri Mbutu minderi bada sukiri Kulondi kia mfuti buidi Baleki biesi bisukiri
Hey ya mbemba mambu mkane Hey ya mbemba biesi bisukiri mama bonga
Mari yaya, mari wangazi Uite yana batasera
kipa kuyaya
Forbes of Lesotho with Spiral Aloe.
Well, Kenya's mobile money industry could undergo a serious shakeup thanks to new technology. A Kenyan bank is rolling out its own mobile network using a new paper-thin SIM card that sits on top of an ordinary SIM. But the industry's leader, Safaricom, says thin SIMs could lead to data theft and fraud. Hillary Hewler has more from Nairobi.
For years, mobile money, perhaps Kenya's most successful invention, has been transforming the way Africans do business and send money home. The service was launched by Kenyan mobile operator Safaricom, and in Kenya, Safaricom's M-Pesa enjoys a near monopoly when it comes to transferring money via mobile phones. But now, the company could be facing its first serious challenge in the form of a new technology that threatens to upend the mobile money sector. Equity Bank CEO James Mwangi told Kenyan lawmakers the new SIM cards his company is launching are all about making mobile money more accessible to the masses.
It's all about security, it's all about affordability, it's all about accessibility that has made us to make this choice. We want to do exactly what we did in banking, leveling the playing field.
What Equity will soon be offering are thin SIM cards, chips embedded in sheets of plastic that lie on top of a standard SIM card, making two networks available simultaneously without forcing a customer to choose. Through its newly launched telecom network, Equity says it will offer mobile money at slashed rates, 1/16th of what Safaricom charges. But Safaricom has been battling the thin SIM rollout through the courts and regulators, claiming the technology is unsafe. Using two cards at once could lead to stolen PIN numbers and mobile money fraud, Safaricom's Steve Chege told a parliamentary committee in September.
We are saying that that step of transferring money from the bank to your mobile wallet is visible to the thin SIM. The PINs that you put in are visible to the thin SIM. And for that reason, it adds a new layer of uncertainty, a new layer of possibility for fraud, a new layer of possibility for interception by third parties who may have malevolent desires to access your money.
Nevertheless, thin SIMs have been approved in Kenya for a one-year trial. Banks like Equity can move money easily and cheaply, points out Danson Njue, telecoms analyst for the research firm Ovum. If successful, they could eventually come to dominate the mobile money market, he says.
We are looking at banks obtaining licenses for telecommunication services. And you know that mobile operators don't have licenses for banking. So I think from that you can clearly see who the winners will be.
As a new technology, mobile money remains fairly unregulated, he says. But if the regulators decide to step in, mobile operators could find themselves in a tight corner.
If it happens that a regulation comes that restricts them from introducing certain services that looks more like a bank, then we'll have banks who have telco services actually being left to rule the market.
With stakes this high, Njoy adds, plenty of African companies will be watching carefully to see how the thin SIM works in Kenya.
If this technology is successful, then obviously we'll be seeing a lot of other players adopting this kind of a technology. It's a very important development because its success or failure in this case is going to be to determine so many things.
Thin SIMs are expected to become available in Kenya soon. In the meantime, Safaricom says its concerns still stand, and the company is reviewing its legal obligations to its customers. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Danish government says Zimbabwe should first address human rights issues in the country and compensate commercial farmers who were disposed of their land during the controversial land reform program, which began in 2000, as conditions for re-engagement. European Union member countries have recently and individually started to rebuild their relations with Harare, but visiting Danish Trade and Cooperation Development Minister Mogens Jensen says his country will only re-engage after Zimbabwe takes steps to address these concerns. Erwin Chifera reports from Harare.
Speaking to journalists after meeting ministers Patrick Chinamasa and Joseph Made of Finance and Agriculture respectively, and Reserve Bank Governor John Manguja, Jensen, who is on a three-day visit to Harare, said Denmark strongly believes in human rights, adding this forms the basis of their support to developing countries, including Zimbabwe. He said while Zimbabwe's economy is in bad shape, it has a potential to develop if necessary reforms are implemented. The reforms, he said, include debt resolution, the compensation of white farmers who lost their land under the controversial land reform program, and clarification of the country's indigenization law.
Debt relief is not easy, and it will require reforms in different areas, and also further land reform, including compensation, as also enshrined in the constitution, is important for reinforcing, I think, the agricultural sector, which is and I think we agree on that, the backbone of the economy.
Chinamasa assured Jensen Zimbabwe would clarify the indigenization law, adding the government is ready to compensate the white farmers, but would do so once resources became available.
Under our constitution, we have an obligation to compensate white farmers. If there is any failure at the moment, it's the same failure that we have to service our debt. It's not out of an intention not to compensate, but out of lack of resources to compensate.
He said following the lifting up of sanctions by the European Union and the re-engagement talks, he expected the Danish government to channel all development support through the government to ensure transparency. Jensen said his government was ready to support Zimbabwe in a number of areas, including agriculture and energy.
Denmark will proceed with our cooperation with Zimbabwe over the coming years in three areas: when it comes to good governance, justice and accountability, when it comes to infrastructure rehabilitation, and also when it comes to developing of the agricultural sector.
Denmark is currently supporting the Judicial Service Commission in the construction of 30 courthouses across the country. The indigenization law requires foreign-owned companies with assets of more than $500,000 to cede or sell a 51% stake to black locals. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Thwaites, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States recently co-sponsored the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists. On this day and every day, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, we affirm that ending impunity is both a moral imperative and a practical necessity in creating free, open, and stable societies around the world. Every day, brave journalists take extraordinary risks to write stories that expose corruption, ask tough questions, or bear witness to the suffering of innocent men, women, and children subjected to the horrors of war and human rights abuses. In their service to humanity, hundreds of journalists have been targeted and killed in the past decade alone, while countless more have been harassed, threatened, imprisoned, and tortured. In the overwhelming majority of these cases, the perpetrators of these senseless crimes against journalists, sometimes regimes or governments, but also terrorist organizations such as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, go unpunished. Syria has been a particularly deadly country for journalists, where the Bashar al-Assad regime and ISIL continue to censor the media through vicious and heinous attacks, including disappearing and kidnapping journalists to stop the free flow of information to the outside world. The United States demands an end to impunity for those who use violence to silence their critics and demands answers on behalf of all the journalists and their families who still have not seen justice served. Moreover, the United States calls on all parties to the Syrian conflict to protect journalists in Syria and its neighbors. Above all, said Secretary Kerry, we stand in awe of the courage of those who risk their lives to tell the stories the world needs to hear. The United States, said President Barack Obama, commends the priceless contributions by journalists to the freedom and security of us all, shining light into the darkness and giving voice to the voiceless.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
What exactly is Ebola?
Can I catch Ebola through the air?
Are the people who have it contagious?
What is our government doing about Ebola?
What are the symptoms of Ebola?
You have questions about Ebola? Straight Talk Africa has answers. VOA presents Straight Talk Africa, Ebola, Knowledge is Life. A special town hall meeting with leading experts on the front lines who will answer many of the questions surrounding the Ebola outbreak. VOA presents Straight Talk Africa, Ebola, Knowledge is Life. November 19th, only on VOA.